We're in a series called Canoeing the Mountains, which is why there is a canoe on the platform. And it's based on Lewis and Clark's expedition, or the metaphor is, because when they were going to explore the western part of the country, they took canoes after the Louisiana Purchase, and then all of a sudden they came upon the Rocky Mountains, and they realized they had made this huge plan on a faulty premise. They had assumed that what was ahead of them was going to be like what was behind them. And we're talking about this because we are in a post-Christian world, but most of our churches in America were planted during the age of Christendom. And what that means is that what is ahead of us is not like what is behind us. And let me say as clearly as possible, I'm very grateful for what is behind us. For decades, we've done good things really well. And often when we're talking about a transition of some kind, it can feel like we're saying the way we did it in the past was wrong. But that's not true at all. Here's what I want you to hear above anything else this morning. I believe the desire to please God honestly pleases God. And I was spiritually formed by these kinds of assemblies, but what is ahead of us is not like what is behind us. And since this leadership takes Jesus' Great Commission seriously, we believe it is our North Star above all other things, we have to take the world we live in now seriously. So I don't know if y'all know this, but my wife, Leslie, originally, she didn't grow up in a Christian home. She was not, her stepfather was a Palestinian Muslim. She had no background. One day she goes into Mesquite High School. She goes up to a person, senior, carrying a Bible, and she just says, "Will you take me to church?" Right out of a Jewel Miller film strip kind of scene. And he takes her to Mesquite Church of Christ, where Josh Kaysinger grew up. And Leslie was going to go to A&M and winds up not. She goes to Harding, where she meets the man of her dreams. And it didn't work out with him, so then she met me. And after we had dated for a while, we, you know, took things to the next level. You know, getting chapel seats together, next level. And so we're sitting next to each other in chapel, and she's this brand new Christian. I'm having to lean over all the time and explain certain things, but I didn't get ahead of the curve on one. Because they sing, "I stand in awe," and I see this young baby Christian do it. And she was the only one in chapel standing. And afterwards, I took her aside and corrected her. Seriously, if I could do one thing different in that first year of dating, it would have been, I wouldn't have had that conversation. "Leslie, don't you know that when they sing certain things, they don't always mean you're supposed to do it? And when you did that, you're just showing off." We talked last week, and by the way, every week builds on each other. We talked last week about how every single time in the Bible that God condemns people's worship, outside of one example I can think of, 99% of the time, when God condemns people to worship, it has nothing to do with how they're worshiping, but the fruit that it was bearing from their worship. That is, it is not so much when people get the ritual right, which is a great thing to do. I want to get the ritual. I think forms can matter, but that's not what God talks about in the Bible. It's not about when you get it right, but when it, when what you do on a Sunday morning or when you're worshiping doesn't change the way you live or act in the world. And I would argue in American Christianity, not just Churches of Christ, but in American Christianity, we have for the most part reversed that formula. Most of the times when Christians across the world and in every fellowship talk about worship, we critique the how and the what people do and not the fruit of it. But that is not how God does it. So think about how worship is talked about in the Bible. Do you remember in 2 Samuel 6 where the Ark of the Covenant is coming in and King David, a man after God's own heart, is so excited. He is dancing and worshiping. And his wife, Michal, looks and sees and she says, "He's undignified." And David says, "You know what? I'll become even more undignified than this." And he's worshiping with total abandon. And it's kind of past the line. When you read that story, You side with Michal. She's right. It's unbecoming of a king. And God sides with David, not with Michal. What about Judas? There's this time where Jesus has just raised this man from the dead, Lazarus, and then his sister Mary takes a year's worth of oil, wages, that could have done a lot of good, and she breaks it open and wastefully, extravagantly pours the oil on Jesus. And Judas says, you know what? This money could have been spent on what? The poor. I grew up poor. He's right. That's wasteful, Mary. I mean, that's what, like $40,000 today? Can you imagine if somebody just lit that on fire and said they're worshiping the Lord? But what are you doing, Mary? And if I'm honest reading that story, I would have sided with Judas. Or there's this one time in Luke 7 where Jesus is at a religious leader's house and they're talking about theology, and in busts this sinful, immodest woman, and she lets her hair down and she's crying and her tears are getting on Jesus' feet and she's rubbing his feet with her hair. And in that society, culturally, it was incredibly immodest for a woman to have her hair down. And Simon just quietly judges. He doesn't even say anything out loud. He just quietly judges. If Jesus knew who this was, he would not be okay with this. And the problem wasn't that Jesus didn't know who it was. The problem was Jesus also knew who Simon was. And he said, she is doing this because she has been forgiven much. And who is forgiven much loves much. There's this time when Jesus is going to Jerusalem and the people are shouting Hosanna because they think he's the Messiah. And they're getting a little too carried away. And so the religious leaders, the Pharisees, come up to Jesus and they say, hey, look, could you ask your people to tone it down a little bit? And Jesus says, you know what? If they didn't do this, the rocks would have to cry out. Every single one of those stories I just told you, I, if I'm honest with myself, would have sided with the people critiquing the worship and not the people worshiping. But every single time in the Bible, when someone is critiquing someone's worship, every single time, God sides with the person worshiping and against the person critiquing. In my ministry experience and in my life, I have learned you can tell more about the person judging other people's worship than you can the person worshiping. One of the things I've realized about myself is one of the things I deal with is I am afraid of emotion in worship. I wasn't raised with it. Maybe you weren't raised with it. But the Bible isn't afraid of our emotion. It encourages expression. We talk about biblical worship, but when people from other cultures come to our worship assemblies, I think they would want to point out there are a lot of places in the Bible that talk about expressions, bodily expressions. So I printed off a few hundred copies of this, if you can put that up there. This is just some of the places in the Bible it talks about worshiping with our entire bodies. And there's some copies up here of these scriptures if you'd like to go home and check that out. But it's everything from bending the knee to bowing your head to raising your hands to lying prostrate on the ground to clapping your hands to standing and sitting and dancing. I know some of you are like, wait a second, dancing? I'm out. Me too. When I dance at home with our kids, it looks like I'm having a seizure of some kind. But I came by this honest, and I bet you did too, because you know the history of our fellowship? Churches of Christ came about a couple hundred years ago during American revivalism. And what was happening in American revivalism is these giant revivals that were sweeping across the country where people were being saved and they were having some kind of charismatic experience, like being slain in the spirit or speaking in tongues, and that was the confirmation of their salvation. And Alexander Campbell, one of the pioneers of our movement, comes along, and all these people who were going to those revival meetings but weren't having those kinds of experiences, they were afraid of, guess what? Not being saved. And Alexander Campbell comes along and he does this really great thing where he tells people, no, you are not the marker of your salvation is not whether you have some kind of speaking in tongues, slain in spirit moment. He wasn't against all that necessarily. Maybe a little bit he was. But his big thing was, listen, if you've been saved, if you've heard the gospel, if you believe the gospel, if you've repented of your past life, if you've confessed Jesus as your Lord, and if you've been baptized. So our group of people started with people who were, in this time of a great emotional revivalism, they, our group started with a group of people who weren't having those experiences. But that's our heritage, but that's not our entire heritage, is it? When I was growing up at the Haskell Church of Christ, I remember every single time that we prayed, these elderly men would get down off their pew and they would get down on their knees. I remember Brother Foy, when he would sing or baptize people, he would raise his hands because it's in the Bible to raise your hands. I know some of you are thinking, why are we talking about this? And the reason why is because our tradition came about a couple hundred years ago squarely in what is called the Enlightenment movement. Enlightenment movement. It means that we were taught to think real scientifically and logically, which is great. It's one of our strengths. I was taught how to love God with my mind. And this, by the way, is why we grew so much as a fellowship during the 1940s and 1950s. Because that was the middle of the apex of modernity. But we don't live in modernity anymore. We live in a postmodern era. And this is one of the biggest breakdowns that has happened in the last three generations. We are a left-brained fellowship in a right-brained world. And I'm not saying we need to switch, and no, but I'm saying God wants us to use both sides of our brains. You know, for some of us, our worship is so kind of you know what word I'm trying to say, but mental. Is that mind? Okay, cerebral, that's it. Flavel Yakely is a well-known Harding church consultant, worked with tons of churches of Christ, and 20 years ago, so this is really dated, but this was true 20 years ago, so it got even more true, I think, later. 20 years ago, he did an exit interview with 500 people who were leaving churches of Christ, and the number one or number two reason for 350 of those people for why they were leaving is that they didn't experience joy in the assembly. And here's why I want you to hear that. Because for, you know, in the 60s and 70s, the culture around us, this is not the church, this is the culture around us. In the 60s and 70s, they had this big idea that basically what a human being was an idea receptacle. Like you were a brain on a stick, in other words, and you just needed to fill that with knowledge and information. A great way to describe the modernism to postmodernism is, do you remember Star Trek? You remember who the apex of humanity was? It actually wasn't a human, it was a Vulcan. What's his name? Spock, yeah. And Spock is the guy who, he doesn't have any emotions. He's cold and logical. But remember Star Trek The Next Generation, and I realize I'm a little bit of a nerd at this point, but Star Trek The Next Generation, the Spock character was a guy named, anybody remember? Data. And Data, his problem, he was a robot, but what did Data want? He wanted to feel. He wanted emotional. This is the difference between modernism and postmodernism. Because, and by the way, they both have strong points. Because a human being isn't just a brain on a stick. We are not primarily just the ideas we know. We are, Christianity has said for a couple of thousand years, we are fundamentally what we love. And by the way, this is why a preacher can preach eloquent sermons and you can have the best Bible class curriculum and you can have all kinds of information about Christianity but not look very much like Jesus. It's why 30, 40 years ago when advertisers were trying to sell you toothpaste, you know how they used to do it? They used to give you information and they would say, 9 out of 10 dentists recommend this toothpaste. These days you don't see advertisements like that, do you? These days, if they want to sell you toothpaste, they say, wouldn't you like to be good and kissed? Because it's a difference between information and what you love. And we think, you know, those ads, that stuff, that doesn't work on us, but I'd like to go to your house and your garage and your attics and your closets and point out the very things that we're buying are because of those kinds of advertisements, addressing what we love. And realizing this actually helps us change not just our ideas, but our lives. And while the churches of Christ were born in modernity, the Christian culture was not. And it has a lot to say about this transition in our culture. The Christian tradition began in the Middle East with people who are very expressive. Now, we are a long way today from throwing ash on our heads and tearing our clothes, but we want to be like the first century Christians. And if first century Christians were to walk into a typical American church, they would not understand unemotional worship. The reason the Bible talks about doing these things with your body when you're worshiping is because you're an embodied person. The Bible knows God can't command you to feel something, but your heart can follow your body. So in the act of closing my eyes or kneeling or clapping or raising my hands, you're helping your heart shape what you care about. So there's all kinds of ways that Christians participate. How many of y'all have heard of Tim Hawkins? Okay, Tim Hawkins is a Christian comedian. He has this bit on raising your hands in church, and he starts off by saying, let me do this. How many of y'all don't like raising your hands in church? Yeah, right? That's the bit, yeah. But then he talks about, look, you can. There's all kinds of ways you can raise your hands. The first is, there's the, you know, start off slow, elbow flap, you know, and then you go to the carry the TV, just a little subtle carry the TV. Then after you're comfortable there, you go to big screen, right? Then my fish was this big, my fish was this big. Then hold my baby, hold my baby. And then, what's it, goalpost, heartburn. And then you, once you feel, you know, like you're still starting to get into it, you can go hold my baby to Mufasa. Mufasa is a good one. And then when you feel like you're when you feel like you're really warmed up, you can go Village People, Rocky, touchdown, right? I say that's funny, but think about this. What do you communicate when you raise your hands? Take it outside of church. You're an embodied person. You use your body all the time. What are you communicating when you raise your hands? Help, SOS, I surrender, I give up. Every day when I come home, our three-year-old Judah runs up to me with his hands up, and I don't say, get away from me, you little charismatic, right? He's reaching for his dad. And there's not a grandparent here who would slap away their grandkids' hands when they were reaching for them. I raise my hands in worship. I have for the last 15 years. And let me tell you, I'm not trying to get you to pay attention to me. I'm uncomfortable with the idea you might be paying attention to me. But when I do, I'm trying to say something to God about God. Think about what you can do when you raise your hand. I'm ascribing to God the greatness of God. When we sing something like, Jesus is Lord, that's true about you, God. We're praying for God to give us something. I hold out my hands like I'm asking for a gift. Now listen, that doesn't mean you need to do that. Matter of fact, there's some of you I know you don't need to do that. But the point is, in the Bible, every time people judge some other people's worship, God sides on the person worshiping and not the person critiquing. Some of us need to give permission to other people to keep their hands in their pockets, because that can be just as spiritual and reverent and exuberant as somebody who's got both hands up. And others of us need to give permission for people to raise their hands without feeling like they're being judged. Listen, I love the way Randy Harris says it. It's one of my best friends. He goes, look, I don't think clapping in church is a sin. I just don't think God wants me doing it. I know there's a lot of you in here that God does not want clapping, okay? So you may be thinking, well, what are you saying? Does that mean just anything goes when it comes to worship? No, of course not. But now you're ready for the chapter in the Bible where Paul actually addresses our assemblies and how we worship. Turn with me to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, starting in verse 1. Paul is writing this church in Corinth that's got a lot of divisions and a lot of spiritual pride and elitism, and it's crept up in their worship. Some people are thinking they're better than others, and there's chaos in the worship service. And so Paul says to them, follow the way of love and eagerly desire gifts of the Spirit, especially prophecy. For anyone who speaks in a tongue does not speak to people, but to God. Indeed, no one understands them. They utter mysteries by the Spirit, but the one who prophesies speaks to people for their strengthening, encouraging, and comfort. Anyone who speaks in a tongue edifies themselves, but the one who prophesies edifies the church. I would like every one of you to speak in tongues, but I would rather have you prophesy. The one who prophesies is greater than the one who speaks in tongues, unless someone interprets so that the church may be edified. Now, brothers and sisters, if I come to you and speak in tongues, what good will I be to you unless I bring you some revelation or knowledge or prophecy or word of instruction? Even in the case of lifeless things that make sounds, such as the pipe or harp, how will anyone know what tune is being played unless there is a distinction in the notes? Again, if the trumpet does not sound a clear call, Who will get ready for battle? So it is with you. Unless you speak intelligible words with your tongue, how will anyone know what you are saying? You'll just be speaking into the air. Undoubtedly, there are all such sorts of languages in the world, yet none of them is without meaning. If then I do not grasp the meaning of what someone is saying, I am a foreigner to the speaker, and the speaker is a foreigner to me. So it is with you. Since you are eager for the gifts of the Spirit, try to excel in those that build up the church. For this reason, the one who speaks in a tongue should pray that they may interpret what they say. For if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays, but my mind is unfruitful. So what shall I do? I will pray in the Spirit, but I will also pray with my understanding. I will sing with my spirit, but I'll also sing with my understanding. Otherwise, when you are praising God in the Spirit, how can someone else who is now put in the position of an inquirer say amen to your thanksgiving, since they do not know what you are saying? You are giving thanks well enough. You're worshiping well enough, but no one else is edified. I thank God that I speak in tongues more than all of you, but in church I would rather speak in five intelligible words to instruct others than 10,000 words in a tongue. When Paul says worship in spirit, we Westerners tend to think he's talking about, that means non-physical, but that's not what Paul means. Paul is a Jew, not a 21st century American, and Paul's trying to correct this problem that had developed at Corinth. They thought that they could just worship in tongues without engaging their mind at all. And Paul is saying, no, true worship has to engage your mind too. If he was here today, he would say worship needs to engage your mind and your body. Paul's point isn't that the mind isn't just a mental break to make sure you don't get too carried away. His point is you're becoming like what you worship. And if you're worshiping the one true God, you ought to be developing maturity in mind, body, heart, and strength. When you look at a Christian worshiping, you ought to see a whole human being worshiping with every part of themselves to the Lord. However that looks like for you. And honestly, sincerely, no judgment. Let's be a church that does not judge how each other worships, because that never goes well in the Bible if we're trying to worship by the book. But did you notice how important it was for Paul that other people understand what was going on? Okay, so in verse 20, he goes on, brothers and sisters, stop thinking like children. In regard to evil, be infants, but in your thinking, be adults. In the law, it is written, with other tongues and through the lips of foreigners, I will speak to this people. But even then, they will not listen to me, says the Lord. Tongues then are a sign for not for believers, but for unbelievers. Prophecy, however, is not for unbelievers, but for believers. So if the whole church comes together and everyone speaks in tongues and inquirers or unbelievers come in, will they not say that you're out of your mind? But if an unbeliever or an inquirer comes in while everyone is prophesying, they are convicted of sin and are brought under judgment by all, as the secrets of their hearts are laid bare, so they will fall down and worship God, exclaiming, God is really among you. Paul's whole goal, or two goals in this chapter, is that everything would be done for the entire church body, and that when people come in from the outside, they would be able to understand what was going on, and they would realize God really is in this place. Listen, I know when you hear speaking in tongues, you think that's not a thing that we have. But every church culture has their own form of speaking in tongues. A few months ago, when we were doing the Thanksgiving boxes for the community, which was awesome. We had like hundreds of people come, and we were able to help bless hundreds of our neighbors with giving them Thanksgiving boxes. But one of these people was a woman named LaQuisha, and I talked to LaQuisha for like 45 minutes to an hour. Had a great conversation. She did not have a church home. I invited her here, told her we could use her help to roll up her sleeves and bless the city of Little Rock. Just a great conversation. And then she started talking like she was going to come, so I had to prepare her. I said, okay, LaQuisha, we do not worship with instruments. And she goes, on purpose? Like, did y'all not pay the bills? That's what she asked me, actually. I've had some version of that question for 20 years, starting with my own wife. And I'm telling you, for people on the inside, I know it might sound like a stretch, but having a worship team can help make our assemblies more understandable for an outside person coming in. Because remember, every song is a new song to a new person. And for some of us, the best way to see this would be to go to another fellowship that's different than this one, or maybe even another kind of worship assembly that's not even Christian. Let me tell you a story. So y'all have met, a lot of y'all have met my Indian brother, Simran, who's a Sikh and stayed with us when we were in high school. About, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago, Simran talked me and Leslie and mom and dad to going to the Sikh temple in Dallas. It is the only time in human history a man named Cletus has been in a Sikh temple. And if you've never been, here's what it's like. You go in and they make all the men put on a turban. So that's something. Cletus wore a turban. And we went in and we've got our turbans on and you go into their auditorium and there's no chairs or pews. It's all little pillows on the ground. And you're like, what is going to happen here? Are we about to take a nap? And there's this little bed in the corner and there's, you know, tassels and stuff. And they say some stuff, and they say some stuff in English because you're a guest, but for the most part, everybody sits kind of cross-legged, and then they bring out a book, and they're fanning the book, and they're talking about something in the book, and then they say some stuff, and then everybody stands up and gets in a parade formation. And you go on a parade formation through the thing as you go and lay the book down in the ground. And I know that sounds really, really strange and odd, but they do that all the time. And for people in a world where the fastest growing religious demographic is nuns, there are people in the city of Little Rock right now who have never been in a church building. I know that sounds far-fetched, but pretty soon it won't be. Pretty soon you'll know their names and their faces. Paul wants our assemblies to be for God first and foremost. We're not going to lose that. Our assemblies to be second for the church, building up the church. And thirdly, for outsiders whom God is calling. Because every week, God is calling people to come to church. People who have been praying for their kids or their grandkids or friends to come to church. And we want to be ready for them. That's why Paul is so strict on making sure that what we do is accessible for outsiders. Remember what frames the whole discussion for Paul? Before he gets into, now about your assemblies in 1 Corinthians 10. In 1 Corinthians 9, he says, look, to the Jew I became a Jew. To the Gentile I became a Gentile. To the strong I became strong. To the weak I became weak. But I became all things to all people so that by all possible means I might save some. That's 1 Corinthians 9, 19 through 23. This is not a recipe for relativism. Paul is reminding us in every culture there are things that do not directly contradict Scripture and are therefore neither forbidden or commanded. And so in love and humility, such cultural features should generally be adopted to keep from making the gospel unnecessarily foreign. Let me give you some examples. When we decided to speak in English, when we decided to have an English-speaking service, we made a missionary decision. Churches don't worship in Latin anymore because we don't speak Latin. We don't worship in Swahili because we don't speak Swahili. We speak English. That's the principle of 1 Corinthians 14. Worship should be intelligible. And that means that style ought to change over time so that the language is what the worshipers can understand, speak, and engage with. If the church takes this seriously, it will necessarily encourage changes in musical styles in order to communicate with different generations. And by the way, aren't you glad the church has done that? Every time you sing The Greatest Command, every time you sing Someday, you're standing on the shoulders of men and women who in the 13th century introduce this. And you know in the 13th century there were people who were like, where's four-part harmony at in the Bible? Music is a language. It's simply a language. So style is fluid. And worship leaders, the responsibility that your worship minister has is to try to help all of the congregation from all the different backgrounds we come to figure out how it's best for us to interact with God together. Worship should stay contemporary in the very best sense of that word. That doesn't mean new songs and not old hymns. It means that to help this congregation be able to sing its own heart to God and be intelligible to people who are coming in from the outside. That's what we're talking about. Because the Bible doesn't condone or condemn one person up on the platform singing. And the Bible doesn't condone or condemn a team of singers. We say we speak where the Bible speaks and we're silent where the Bible is silent. But in my experience, we say a whole lot where the Bible is silent. Okay, so there are three concerns when it comes to having a worship team. And I want to address them now. One is gender. So gender, this, elders see this as under the leadership of Josh, who's under the leadership of the eldership. They don't see this as a leadership role. When I was interviewing with the elders 18 months ago, more than that now, 20 months ago, after like 4 hours of talking, Brother Lewis Starling comes up to me. Lewis Starling is a 96-year-old shepherd. He's been a shepherd here longer than I was alive. And the last thing he said to me before I left that night was, "I've always wondered, why do people call it usurping authority if an elder gave a woman permission to do it?" Truthfully, the leadership didn't see this. They didn't study women's roles to make this decision. For the most part, we don't see this as a gender issue. And if you do, maybe we can sit down one-on-one and talk to you about it. But I'll tell you this, back in the 30s, one of our shepherds told me this week, when we started singing Home of the Soul and Paradise Valley, there was an uproar among certain people who thought that the women were leading that because it was too strong of an alto lead. So maybe we can sit down and study it if that is something that you're concerned about. But listen, in 1 Corinthians 14, in the chapter we just read, Paul goes on to say, if any one of you has a hymn, let them sing. And he uses the word for both men and women there. And yes, Paul does say some stuff on gender in this letter, in this chapter. In chapter 14, he says women should be silent. And then he goes on immediately to say women and men should both be eager to prophesy. And he had just said a couple of paragraphs earlier that whenever women pray and prophesy, they should cover their heads. And good and godly people have been debating what that means for 2,000 years. What I have seen in my time in ministry is that often when churches start studying this, not always, but often, it can become just another way of becoming an internally focused church, maybe just more on a progressive issue. So this is not us about trying to be a progressive church of Christ. Again, I mean this sincerely. Progressive and conservative Christianity is a luxury that you used to have in the world of Christendom. This is about trying to be a mission-driven church. Our fellowship is in decline because we have spent way too much time arguing about secondary matters and neglecting primary ones, like the Great Commission. Okay, so the second objection is performance. That's a pretty subjective term because what might be performance to you might be someone else sincerely worshiping. And I would like to caution anybody from judging someone else's worship. But also, I'd like you to remember, this is us. This is not some outsiders coming in to put on a show. Sometimes when people talk about this, it seems like we've assumed that this is going to be Josh and the Jackson 5 or something. But it's not. It's going to be us worshiping. Nobody thinks Jason and Amy Burton or Janice Northern or Lee Dunbar or Josh Biddle or that. In fact, this is actually one of the strongest arguments for a worship team. We say we want to be like the early Christians, which, by the way, is a great thing. Makes my heart swell when we talk like that. We want to be like the early Christians, but then we just kind of assumed a lot of stuff that the early Christians didn't have, that really came from medieval Catholicism. Stuff like this auditorium and these pews. Where did the first Christians worship? In homes, in caves. When Paul writes Ephesians, this verse that we really love, look at this, in Ephesians 5:19, he says to us, "Speak to one another with psalms, hymns, and songs from the Spirit. Sing and make music from your heart to the Lord." Sing to one another, he says. We don't do that. We sing to the back of each other's heads. Because the way that our auditoriums, our form has actually shaped us more than we know. How does every youth group set up chairs when they're going to have a Devo? In a circle. How do you set up chairs when you're in life group? In a circle. One of the things this does is just turn the pew around. Helps us sing, helps make the auditorium more like a circle. It helps us see each other better as worship. And by the way, outside of our fellowship, this is really clear. We've had conversations with leaders outside of Churches of Christ, and they say, it seems like this is the performance. Just one person up here. It takes the focus off one person and puts it on a variety of people as they guide our worship. Okay, the third criticism is participation. And this is the one that I assure you Josh and I and the shepherds are going to be keeping a close eye on. Because we want to make sure participation goes up, not down. By the way, this is not a new problem. 500 years ago, Soren Kierkegaard, Danish. What do you call the Danish? Huh? IKEA, that's right. So he's a Danish guy. I really can't remember where that city, Denmark, is that what you were saying? Anyway, you know what I'm saying. Soren Kierkegaard, 500 years ago, he lives in a world where everybody's Christians, and he says, you know what's happened? He said, when you make the auditorium like a theater or a stadium, what happens is you turn all the church from participants into an audience. And so we judge, did you like it? I liked it. I didn't like it. But every Sunday, you're not the audience. Who's the audience, church? God is the audience. Your performers, the people on the platform, by the way, I don't call it a stage. I never call it a stage because stage is for entertainment. Platform is for engaging. The people on the platform are just providing cues as we perform for God. Think about corporate worship as a basketball game or football game. Can you imagine a football game or basketball game where the players sit down and watch the coaches? Of course not. And that is the difference between this being a show and us being the performance together. Think about if we hired Sam Pittman to coach the Hogs without any assistant coaches. We've asked Josh to make our a cappella worship as good as possible, and currently he's kind of like a head coach who's trying to do everything by himself. Listen, it is no secret I'm fully supportive of this, but I want you to hear the heart behind it. I think this is important because all the things we've said are our priorities are embodied by this. Generational generosity. Y'all know last week we sent our student ministries to Winterfest, right? We have been sending them to Christ Teens and Winterfest for years, and they worship with a worship team. We must not disciple our kids to graduate church when they graduate high school. But on the other side of this, generational generosity, we're not just going to sing new songs. We're not just going to sing songs written in the 90s. We're going to sing some of the older hymns. And your shepherds are committed to singing a cappella. Why? Because we want to be a church where grandkids and grandparents can worship together and we can all be mutually disappointed to the glory of God. I'm serious about that line. Because this is what it looks like to end worship wars. All over the country in the 60s and 70s and 80s, there was a battle between the World War II generation and the baby boomers. World War II generation wanted traditional hymns and instrumentation and every fellowship. And the baby boomers wanted more pop, kind of contemporary pop music. And by the 90s, the baby boomers generally won. That's the worship wars that have been going on for 50 years. We're committed to try to being generationally generous, which means navigating a different way than this group gets their way and the other group doesn't. And by the way, Josh is really good at this. Racial reconciliation. This is important because it allows us to have more diversity represented in person, people of color up on the platform, as well as generationally diverse, and in style. I grew up in Benton. I grew up thinking God was white and worship in heaven was going to be Franny Crosby, maybe a little bit of Chris Tomlin. But we need to remember, God is redeeming every single culture, and the church is called to be a manifestation of that there. Do you know the global church? Right now, God is receiving praises from people under mango trees and in strip malls in Latin America, and churches do those things differently, like Brian Alexander and James Arbuckle were talking about last Sunday. And we have to ask, if it doesn't bother God, why does it bother me? Not in an ugly way, but how does God receive this with joy and delight, and yet I struggle to appreciate it? The truth is, it's mostly cultural. The worship wars of the past few decades have been the clash of economic cultures, rich and poor, African American, Hispanic, white, or rural versus urban. And while we've talked theology about it, most of our differences are really cultural differences. And you know who knows this? Anybody who's ever been to a white Church of Christ in the rural country and then a black Church of Christ in the city. They would answer the same way on doctrinal questions, but the style is very different. And while neither one are wrong, they're different. Wars, even worship wars, will always be with us, but these are not from God. The church has to come to grips with the enculturated nature of worship. Whether we kneel or, you know, come down to the front to take communion, or whether we dress up for church or dress casual for church, wars are fought because we do not recognize the cultural character of particular customs, and we don't value how much diversity can illuminate our encounter with God. And by the way, do you know what this would mean in the city of Little Rock to have one of its major institutions have people of color on the platform every week. The other day, when Dalen, our spiritual formation minister, and also a black man, was preaching, Christian Collier leaned over to his mom, Katie, and said, "I like him. He has a brown face like me." And finally, evangelism. This really is my North Star. Every song is a new song to new people. And that brings me back to Leslie. I wish I could go back in time and correct that moment. I wouldn't have corrected her. I would have tried to learn from her. Because she knew what I had forgotten. That God really was worth standing in awe of. And she was someone who had loved much because she had been forgiven much. And this is just speaking for me. But looking back on it, the reason I know I was so hard on her then is because I wasn't comfortable being around somebody that loved God that much. Do you realize how much lost people need this church? There's something real here. God is here. God is in this church body and in these relationships. But do you realize how much we need these people too? Every time someone comes to faith, we're reminded of what we're tempted to forget, that this really is good news. We really have been saved and brought from darkness into the light. You know, before Paul gets into the rules for the assembly, you know what he does? Because it's in very much a moment like this in church life where Paul says, hold on, before we talk about it, I know you're heated, I know you've got your opinions, but listen, love is patient. Love is kind. Love does not envy, it does not boast, it's not proud. And if you have a church service, it doesn't matter how great you think the preaching is, it doesn't matter how great you think the singing is, if you don't have love, you are a clanging gong. I'm telling you, church, this can help us even with that. You know what this means to me? For 10 years in Abilene, every Sunday I got to see a miracle. There was this 85-year-old woman named Winnie Gibbs. She'd had dementia for years, and she had lost all of her memory. She didn't remember her kids' names. She didn't remember her life story. She didn't remember her friends' names. But every Sunday when she got up on the worship team to sing with her son, she remembered every single word. And I got to watch her friends for an hour on a Sunday morning have her back. A couple of months ago, Stan Chapman, one of our shepherds, went up to Josh and said, "Could you please stop singing Good, Good Father when Savannah Stripling is singing on a Wednesday night? Because I can't stop crying." Why? Because she's testifying to God's faithfulness even in the middle of a storm. I think of Brad McCoy on the worship team at Highland, singing the Sunday after Colt got a concussion, singing about standing on the promises. I think about Val Durrington, who's Vicki Dale's brother, singing on Easter Sunday after his mom had died a few days earlier in this week, him singing about God raising Jesus from the dead. Listen, church, Paul says love is patient, love is kind, right in the middle of a conversation like this one, because here's what he wants to say to them and to us. We can get through this. This conflict will not undo us. Our commitments to one another, the bonds that we share, are stronger than where we disagree and what divides us. This issue is serious, and we will deal with it, and we will not sweep anything under the rug. But we are strong enough as a group, and we will learn from this moment and grow stronger together, because the church is God's family. We are a colony of heaven on earth, made for Him and for His glory, and commanded to love each other the way Jesus loves us. And that kind of love never fails.